O God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight. O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. The section of Genesis that George read from, it is from one of the oldest parts of the Bible. It is a collection of ancient stories like the flood and Noah's Ark. One reason why scholars believe that it is so ancient is because of the strange features of the text, such as how chapter 4 ends with an account of Seth being born to Adam and Eve after the death of Abel. Then chapter 5 begins by giving an account of how Seth was born to Adam and Eve after the death of Abel. It repeats itself almost word for word, as if the text was totally unaware of what had come just before. Strange. Plus, that section of Genesis also says that angels were having children with human beings, and those children had superpowers and were living to almost 1,000 years old. That's pretty strange, too. The point is that the methodology of biblical scholars means that strange equals old. And so this is a very old part of the Bible. Probably this collection of stories came from before there was a written Bible, when human affairs were recorded only in the form of myth and stories told at night around campfire. And these stories, they hold human imagination like almost no other part of the Bible. The glorious sight of rainbows. To make meaning of them, people imagined them as God's own enormous archery set hung up forever in the sky. When people discovered enormous bones buried in the earth, to make meaning of this, their imaginations pulled back up from Genesis, pulled up the story of these Nephilim, these angel-human hybrids, and imagined they must have been giants. Many such bones were found in a town in France called Runceval, which made many people believe that a community of these giants must have lived around there in those ancient days. This leads to one of my favorite adjectives in all of the English language, Runceval. Runceval meaning an object that is so large it would be useful for a giant. This section of Genesis, it doesn't just hold imagination in the faraway past either. Magazine copy is still sold with cover photographs of vaguely boat-shaped rocks in the Middle East with the breathless headline, "Breakthrough on Noah's Ark." Spoiler alert, there has not been any such breakthrough on Noah's Ark. From my seat here in modernity, it seems obvious to me that there are much better explanations for these phenomena. These Nephilim thighs, they're dinosaur bones. The boat-shaped rocks, they're just rocks. Or, I'm speculating here perhaps, just some boat. And rainbows. Well, rainbows are an optical illusion. Lights hitting sheets of water droplets hanging in the air, caught like gauzy curtains. The light is bent in the water as though through a million tiny prisms, refracting, diffusing, reflecting, bending the white light into a spectrum. Red bent a little bit less than orange, bent a little bit less than violet, bent a little bit less than ultraviolet, which we cannot even see, and which, yes, nonetheless, hangs suspended in a perfect symmetrical arc. It's wondrous. It's beautiful. But it is not a literal bow and arrow type bow that has been stuck up in the clouds. For one, rainbows aren't seen only in clouds. A rainbow is cast when the light falls right on a children's playing, leaping across a lawn sprinkler in the long afternoons of summer. A rainbow is cast by a disco ball in a humid basement dance club with thumping music waking up the night. There's better explanations, rational explanations for these phenomena that this ancient section of Genesis spins fantastic yarns about, and they are myths. That's what this section of Genesis is doing. It's creating myth. And what a myth is doing, it simply is not the same thing as what a historical account is doing, or what the minutes of a meeting are doing, or what a journal, what a article in the Nature, in the, or what an article in the journal Nature is doing. A myth is trying to communicate something true, and it does so in the form of a story. A myth is trying to explain something. The narrative structure of it is just a vehicle. Whether or not something really happened is simply not the point. Were I to be told the story of a certain tortoise and a certain hare, and were I at the conclusion of said story to say, I don't think that really happened, I would be missing the point. A myth has something true to say. The narrative form is just a vehicle. These stories from Genesis about the flood and the ark and the rainbow, they are intended to share something true about God, to tell us what God is like. And so, dear congregants, at this point, 700 words into the sermon, I have reached the crucial juncture of informing you that I think that this biblical passage has something to say about God. So let's get into it. Before the flood, the world was filled with all manner of wickedness. God had dreams about how these beings who were made in the very image of God had dreams about how these beings might live, what kind of world they might build. But that is not what the world was like. The world was filled with war and violence. God had made a garden of peace. The world was filled with deprivation and hunger. God had made a garden of plenty. The world was filled with division and war. God had made one people of one single flesh. This was not what God had dreamed of. And the wickedness of the world, it rose like a choking and stinking cloud, and it blocked out God's vision. Sitting around the campfire, looking at what was transpiring, wherever God sat, it seemed the smoke was always blowing right into God's eyes. God could barely see anything good, just this one family. God regretted ever having made people in the first place. God looked at humanity and said, "Perhaps they won't be my people after all." The floods came like never-ending bottles of wrath uncorked from the heavens, and it destroyed everything that the people had made. Cities stood in rubble, the cultivated crops were washed away, all the plants drowned, the animals barely survived, the fish, pretty much okay. Little problem with the salinity levels, but overall the fish did fine. When the floods receded, and Noah and all the animals debarked from their oddly rock-shaped boat, all of life stood on the earth as a fragile seedling. Life needed to begin again, needed to begin from almost nothing. God looked around. God looked around at what God had done. God looked around, not down, because in those days, those were the days when God would walk in the garden at the time of the evening breeze. God looked around at the flood. God looked at the destruction that God had wrought, God's own decisions, and God unsteady, uneasy on their feet, head pounding, mouth tasting of sick, straining to remember what of that spree of death was real and what was imagined and what might have been forgotten. God remembered uncorking and draining bottle after bottle of wrath. God looked at their own actions and said, "That's it. That's it. I'm giving that up forever. That's it. I am quitting. I am never picking that up again. God poured out the last of that bottle of wrath down the sink and set it down on the sky, still wet, so that it left a huge ring on the blue firmament kitchen table. God decided then and there, from now on, I will be their God no matter what. No matter what transpires, I will be their God. I will never set out again to destroy. I will be with them. I will never again let the doing of wrong crowd out my love for what is right. I am turning this around here and now, forever and ever. Amen. And God saw that ring of rainbow staining the table and decided to put that rainbow everywhere, as a reminder. Everywhere God would place that rainbow as a reminder, in those places that would most call to mind God's love for humanity, would most remind God of how we are made in God's own image. God placed the rainbow in every afternoon rainstorm that catches people without umbrellas, sending them hustling into shops and under trees and back into their houses, because these creatures, which God had made almost entirely out of water, these creatures didn't like getting wet. It brought a smile to God's face to see the humans in their fussiness. God placed the rainbow everywhere, not just in the clouds. God put it inside the cut glass of prisms and telescopes and said, "This refraction, this is really going to help you figure out just how big this universe that I've made is. Look to the stars. Look for the ones that just are a little bit too red." It brought a smile to God's face to see the humans working it out in their brilliance. God placed the rainbow everywhere. God put it in the sprinklers, waving back and forth in the summer heat with kids, screeching with a joy that reached the highest heavens just to jump through a jet of water. God smiled alongside every parent and forgot as well the troubles of the world in the sound of that laughter. God placed the rainbow everywhere. God put it in the disco balls, in the basement dance club, gay bar, air hot and sweat humid as the rainbows danced on sequins and the music thudded and the bodies were freed to dance like the stars danced at creation, because here there was no judgment. Here they were free as God had made them that first day. God put the rainbow everywhere to be reminded. These have been my people. These are my people. These will be my people forever. As long as light shall bend, they will be my people, and I will be their God. Thanks be to God for that indescribable gift.